AM.
HCMF Federal Recruitment and Talent Management Strategy Day is a one-day training conference to be held Wednesday, May 4th, 2011 in Washington, D.C. The conference will focus on new opportunities for bringing in top talent to the federal government, such as marketing and brand strategies, investing in employee development, and more. Keynotes will be presented by OPM Director John Barry, as well as presentations from seven other Chief Human Capital Officers. For more information, please visit hcmfrecruitmentday.com.
Do you know someone who's done something outstanding in the field of human capital management? Nominate them for Federal News Radio's second annual Causey Awards. Together, we'll call attention to what may be a best practice in government. Anyone can be nominated, career, political, and contractor, working in the HR field. The award is named after Mike Causey and his lifelong dedication to the reporting of management and federal pay and benefit issues. To nominate someone for the Causey Awards, go to federalnewsradio.com, search award.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Good morning and welcome to For Your Benefit. Well, we have a special holiday show with a special guest and a special co-host, and we're going to talk about financial planning, all aspects thereof. Karen Schaefer, certified financial planner, fellow seminar presenter, chairperson of the council that sets standards for certified financial planners worldwide. Good morning, Karen.
Good morning, Bob. Great to be here.
Good. And you jetted in this morning from Botswana, and thank you for
being here. By way of Rockville? Yes, that's me.
And Tammy Flanagan, Senior Benefit Director, NITP, GovExec columnist, fellow seminar presenter. Good morning, Tammy.
Good morning, Bob.
It's been a couple weeks, hasn't it? Okay, Karen, let's do a softball.
Okay.
What's financial planning and why do I need to be concerned about it? Because I'm 24 and I want to spend my money on the things that I didn't spend because I was in school.
It doesn't matter how old you are, Bob. Anybody needs to be doing financial planning. It's the 21st century. Life got a little complicated and no longer can you just get up, be a nice person, go to work and expect to retire and be able to be financially secure. Everybody's going to get problems. People with money will be able to solve the problems and nobody's going to teach you how to take care of yourself and have money. You've got to make a plan and implement the plan and build in a little flexibility. So we got to change up the plan. We know how to do it without falling apart.
Okay, we're going to drill down into some real specifics after we get through the general.
Okay.
But most people are put off by math and money.
Yeah.
And people should not be put off by calling us, though, because we're live today and hopefully there are people listening because it's a holiday. 202-465-3080. 202-465-3080. It's 10:08 Eastern Time. We're on to 10:58 Eastern Time. It is February 21st, so do not call after that time. But please email us. We'll do the email later. Again, 202-465-3080. Okay, so I'm put off by math and money. Mm-hmm. How do I wade into the water? I mean, I hear this stuff, but I don't want to do it. Yeah. I want to do what I want to do, not what I don't do well.
How's your common sense level? You know, arithmetic, it's helpful when we're trying to talk about financial planning. The mystery of money is off-putting to some people if they haven't grown up around anybody who said, you know, you got to put your money into your thrift savings plan or you've got to learn a little bit about stocks and bonds. But quite frankly, it really isn't as complicated as it sounds, and it's important that you simply start with step one. And step one is a little different for every person. Some people really have to stop and say, why am I not getting anywhere? Or what's confusing to me? Some people really have done a pretty good job intuitively. They're not really maxing out on their credit cards. They're just a little confused about what's better, the CS or I funds and the thrift savings plan. So if I can get people to just slow it down a little bit and say, what would be helpful to them? Do they need a little bit of a life coach to get them through a career hump so that there is a little money there? Or do they need just a little primer on the terminology of financial planning?
I think for a lot of people, it's setting priorities that can be tough, because you've got, maybe if you are a young person, college loans to pay off, you're
exactly
trying to
save
for a house.
Right.
You know, compound interest, you want to save for retirement from early on, so how do you prioritize?
Exactly right. But the issue that people face is that it's not going to go away. You know, that whole issue about prioritizing, I still find... Well, we could upgrade the kitchen, or we could buy this car or that car. It's the same thing through your whole life.
And it doesn't matter, it seems, no matter how many pay raises you get or how much money you make, you tend to spend it all.
Funny how that happens. So if we can embed the good habits first, you know, get that thrift plan going and have the appropriate attitude toward debt, the rest of it really does fall into place.
Right.
It's really not that hard.
Exactly. Right. And I always think it's all about how much money you make. It's how you spend the money you have.
Or how much you keep.
How much you save, yeah.
So I follow you often, daily, I think. And
on the seminar circuit?
Everywhere.
Oh, he's stalking you.
Okay. I got your number.
Okay. So people will come up and say, Karen talked about asset allocation. Mm-hmm. Isn't that like a seesaw? Because if one goes up, the other one goes down. But at the end of the day, you're where you started. And I go, no.
Mm-mm.
So what's asset allocation?
Asset allocation is what financial planners and investment advisors call choosing what kind of place, what kind of asset should be attributed to what kind of goal. And we know that we have to put our money someplace. If we just put it under the mattress, it's not going to grow, and yet everything we're trying to spend the money on is growing in cost. So we have to do something with the money, but every single choice I have for where I can put my money has pros and cons. So the idea is I'm trying to find the right mix of choices to meet my particular goals.
Well, there's somebody on the phone with a goal to ask a question.
Excellent. Let's open up that line.
Good morning.
Yeah. How you doing? Can you hear me?
Everything's good.
See, I'm in a unique position that June 1st, I have to apply for Medicare Part B because I'm delaying my Social Security.
Right.
What type of documents do I need? Do I need a birth certificate or what?
You probably don't need anything. Yeah. Have you contacted Social Security yet?
I've contacted them, but they said there's two ways they can do it. One, I can pay on a quarterly basis.
Right.
Or they can have it deducted from my...
Federal retirement.
I get a military pension.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I'm delaying for one simple reason, because a long time ago, I read that some people can treat their Social Security as an allocation to a government bond,
mm-hmm.
because that is backed up by the government bond.
So your question is more about, should I continue to delay receiving Social Security?
I should delay my Social Security as long as possible, in my case.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I just want to make sure, I talked to them, and I think, well, you just pointed out, oh, there's a show up, and they'll help me out somehow mm-hmm. by applying for Medicare Part B, because I'm a military retiree.
Are you still working?
No, I'm in an old soldier's home.
Okay.
Yeah. But the thing is, I'm trying to delay it because as long as I delay it, I get a higher pension, because if this home closes down, I have more money to take care of medical costs. That's right. What I'm going to use that Social Security for, anything pertaining to medical costs.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like a plan. Yeah, you just call Social Security, and you can probably apply for Medicare right over the phone.
Right.
You shouldn't need to provide any documentation.
No.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. That's right. Our thought, but I'm just asking a variety of questions. I've been contacting Social Security on like a monthly basis because June is a couple months away.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
And thanks for your service to the country on today especially.
Right.
All righty, 202-465-3080, NITP's hotline for the next 50 minutes or so. And Karen, we're back mm-hmm. to asset allocation, and people have a hard time with it.
Right.
Like in today's environment, the Middle East, you know, the mm-hmm. bonds are going to go down because interest rates are going to go up, and the mm-hmm. snow showers are going to shut down the central guidance system of all the computers, and I'm going to put my money in the mattress.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would be great for the one day where it fell. But it's not great if you put your money in the mattress after prices have fallen. And it's not great to leave your money in the mattress when life, as we know it, returns to happier times. What we're finding is that a lot of people got scared out of the market. But they didn't get scared out of the market, whether it was the stock market, the bond market, the real estate market, when things were good. They got scared out of the market after prices had fallen quite dramatically. That's the opposite of what a good investor wants to do. A good investor is always trying to buy low, sell high, not watch it drop like a rock and run screaming to the sidelines. As understandable as that is, and as much as we're kind of hardwired with human nature to do that, it was a mistake. Because when it's time to get back in, it really feels wrong. The best day to buy is when everybody is pointing out everything that can possibly go wrong, and you can't hardly see a glimmer of hope. Because on a day like that, where do you think the prices are? Perfect for buying, really, really low. We also know that the markets, especially the stock market, recover before the economy. So if you're reading, you know, headline front page news is all about, excuse me, how we're not getting back to employment yet, and it's going to take a long time. Well, a company that is lean and mean is actually quite profitable. So we've been making money in stock for quite some time, as much as everybody in this studio and listening today knows somebody who's having a very difficult time because of the economy. It doesn't mean we should be sitting on the sidelines with our investments. It means we should have been back in.
Karen, I know that the average person probably doesn't want to read the Wall Street Journal every day and doesn't really follow their investments as they probably should, or and they don't even really emotionally want to sell high and buy low, because
right.
that's opposite of your
human
instinct.
Yep.
So what would the average person do to take advantage of those recommendations, like to do those types of things? Is it really necessary to hire someone to help you, or can you do it on your own in a simple way?
Yeah, I think I don't think it's necessary to hire somebody. I think it's necessary to be honest about what your capabilities are when it comes to making investment decisions and ongoing reallocation decisions. Mm-hmm. If I own more than one kind of investment, they'll perform at different rates at different times. And if I'm using very speculative things or very specific things, I have to watch those more. If I really know myself well enough to know, got a life that's busy, got a temperament that's not really good at the buy low, sell high, and got a job and a career that hasn't really educated me or given me the experience to make fine-tuning judgment calls in the market, I have to go with broad brush. And the easiest way to describe that is forget about fine-tuning the investments based on my personal interpretation of the economy or the tea leaves or whatever indicator I hear is a good one, and go with my personal time frames, because that I can't understand. Mm-hmm. I know that if I'm going to spend money in the next 5 years, I better not take any market risk with that. Market risk is, it can go down, and it will go down, and my luck, it'll go down the day I'm trying to buy the car.
So within 5 years, keep it
I
in
just
the bank.
Stay out of the market. cash equivalents.
Right.
Once I'm beyond 5 years, that's when I can start going into the market, even if the value goes down, I can say, I don't need it today. Sure, glad I'm not selling that today.
Right.
And then I start looking for investments that over long periods of time have risen to keep pace with taxes and inflation, don't require as much ongoing management. We use mutual funds. We use the kind of things that you find in your thrift savings plan.
Right.
Yeah.
We have another caller.
Oh, cool.
Good morning.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and proverbial clear.
Oh, wonderful. I have a question about the volunteer contribution that you guys always talk about.
Okay.
If we put let's say, up to that 10% that we could do for a lifetime salary, what is the conversion to the Roth the mechanism, and what does it take to do that?
Well, first and foremost, don't do this on your own. It's I won't say fraught with issues, but you can do it. You need to be careful, though. You can transfer the entirety of the voluntary contribution, not only what you put into it, but if it's been in there for a week, two, three, or a year, it's earned some interest. And it's a pretty nice interest rate as short-term investments
2.75 this year.
Okay, so we've got some money now that we put in. We have no tax deduction, the huge amount, and we've got some earnings. The form allows you to strip the earnings out and put it into the TSP. So then what you have left is your contribution, which, of course, you got no tax deduction for, and you can move it to a traditional IRA or you can move it to a Roth IRA. If you move it to a Roth IRA, that would appear initially to be the way to go, table pounding. There hasn't been anything like this ever before, and there isn't going to be after the CSRSers are gone. That's true. But in 2009, IRS introduced something called the IRS Notice 2009-68. I don't want to put you to sleep with this, but let's be clear with what it is. IRS interprets tax laws that Congress makes, and they do it with revenue rulings. Now, these things have clout, almost like a law. This is the way IRS feels things should happen. But they also publish something called notices. And notices are, I'm really trying to dummy this down. It's kind of like, we're thinking about this. So it puts people on notice that they're studying something or looking at something. Okay, now how does this apply to the voluntary contribution? If you looked at the voluntary contribution in and of itself and it moved directly to a Roth, there would be no tax because we stripped the earnings out. Nobody could argue with that. Well, IRS came out and said, well, you know, we might just want to aggregate this with the TSP. Now, the term aggregation is kind of like IRA maven talks about coffee and cream. Let's talk about coffee and sugar. You've got coffee without sugar. It's dark, isn't it? Yes. When you put the sugar in, can you tell where the sugar is? No. But when you stir it around, it's aggregated, the sugar and the coffee. So what they're talking about is, let's say that you had $10,000 in the voluntary contribution. I'm just using a number. You can multiply it by whatever your number is. But you also had $20,000 in the thrift. If IRS were to see fit to respond to this, they would say, oh, no, these things are added together. 10 plus 20 is 30. And if you move the 10 from the voluntary contribution into the Roth, they want to tax two-thirds of it. Now, that just stopped your heart, I'm sure. But that's why you shouldn't do this on your own, but be aware. Now, did I say don't do it? No. Do it. Here's the escape valve. Let's say that Congress and or the IRS issues a revenue ruling and says, this is what we're going to do. You have until October 15th of the year after the year in which you do this. So let's say you do this tomorrow. Undo it and say 1,000 pardons, and they call it recharacterize it, and then you just move it over to a traditional IRA, you would not be taxed.
So you don't have to move it back to the voluntary contribution.
You can't move it back to the voluntary contribution.
Once it's out, it's out.
It's like the horse is out of the barn, and it's not going back in. So it can go to a traditional.
You could even go to the bank, because it's money that's already been taxed. So you can put it anywhere you want at that point.
Mm-hmm. So the point being is you don't face some awful tax situation if they blow the whistle. Now, remember, they did this in 2009. We are in 2011. And I haven't seen much, and I'm not going to tell you I'm piped into the person that writes this stuff. But if it does happen, again, you got it. If you are lucky enough maybe to not want to do this in 2011, you might consider doing it January 2nd, 2012, which gives you until 2013 if they change their mind. But I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. You should be aware that it's there, and that's why I say you shouldn't just, you know, do this on your own necessarily. Be aware of all the things that could happen.
You could do this any time before you retire.
Tammy, you know this better than I as to when to tap that and the sensitivity of the timing of tapping it.
Right, yeah, you can. The form that you need to take the money out is called a Retirement and Insurance Form, an RI-38-1-124. 38-124. You can find that on opm.gov/forms, and you'll see it right there. You can fill it out, print it out, mail it in. You can do that anytime you're working during your career, but keep in mind that when you withdraw the money from voluntary contributions, it's a one-way ticket out. You have to take it all out, and you can't put any back in. So sometimes people will wait until they retire. So when you finalize your retirement, you can send in your retirement application along with that RI-38-124 with your retirement. And so when your retirement's in the process of being finalized, you can request that the money be sent at that time. So you have up until the final processing of your retirement. The only downside to waiting until you retire is that the money's going to stop earning interest the day you leave the government. And it could take OPM, right now it's taken OPM on average 5 or 6 months to finalize a case. So that means 5 or 6 months your money sits there and doesn't earn a dime of interest. So a lot of people will do this 6 months before they retire so that it earns interest up until the day they take it out. So you have that freedom.
Plus, I think I want to know that it got there before I left.
Before, right.
You more so than I, but over the last few years, Tammy has probably come to the rescue of at least a half a dozen people where they did the right thing, but they just pushed the envelope too long.
Yeah, this is a program that even though it's available, it's everything we said it is, it's not real widely understood or known, even by those people who are working in the agency personnel offices. And even sometimes the claims examiner you get at OPM has maybe never handled a request for voluntary contributions. Right. So it's really an underused program.
And I get worried that people confuse voluntary contribution with thrift. We make a point of if you're going to move your thrift plan to an IRA, that's not something you really have to rush. And as a retired person, you might have more time to be shopping for who's the right custodian. And people file this voluntary contribution decision with that, I got time on my hands, and you really don't. No. So I'm kind of like Bob. Let's do voluntary contribution before you retire and think about Roth IRAs. Let's get thrift into a different world, different chapter of life, retirement, and think about traditional IRAs.
Yeah, and one last warning on the voluntary contribution is that if you were to retire and you did, as Karen said, just thought, oh, I have a year or two to decide, OPM is going to assume that you had that money in there to purchase a life annuity. And so you won't have the option. They won't come to you and say, what do you want to do with the money? They'll just convert it to an annuity and make it part of your civil service. So if you want to take that money out, you have to initiate that form either during your career, probably best choice, or at the very latest when you retire.
Boy, are you lucky you called today. You got the top two surgeons in the country.
Thank you so much for your expertise.
Thank you for calling.
Welcome. All righty. Karen, we talked about the market dropping. I remember you were probably not out of high school or Tammy, but you were probably both brilliant as into your careers then. But this was, I guess, what, middle 60s or, excuse me, middle
80s? High school. 1987. We're talking about elementary
1980,
school,
where the market dropped 500 points.
1987, October.
Okay, you
Monday.
Remember it well. And I remember it well. I mean, people were, and I'm not a financial planner, and they're going, what do I do? But the sharpest one called up and said, what do you think I should buy?
Exactly right.
And this person, still a good friend to today, went in, and I, you know, me, you know me, I'm not a financial planner. I go, well, you know, what do you think? And I go, put it in the mattress, and he said no, and bought high quality stuff.
Well, I had a couple of, we did a little bit of that at the office with people calling in and saying, is this really a good day to buy? And it was like opening the Wall Street Journal. You couldn't go online back then and say, okay, do you think this one's going out of business? I don't think so. What do you think? And I mean, the hardest part of the day was getting somebody in New York to answer the phone and take the trade, because it was horrible. But what I always want people to remember is that the market is going to continue to go up and down. It's going to continue to have horrible days, maybe even horrible seasons year after year where things absolutely not good. And it's never easy. I mean, making money is always going to be a bit of work. But on the other hand, what you have to remember is the alternative to staying on the sidelines isn't getting us anywhere. And it's almost as if right now we're being forced to get back into the market with these really, really low interest rates. It's like, I feel like the Fed is telling us, go out and play. Come on, you know, we can't have a thriving economy if everybody's afraid and on the sidelines. So you have to manage that risk. The risk of being on the sidelines is that you have a pile of money that doesn't buy anything. If I'm going to live half as long as my 89 and a half year old mother, then I have to realize that buying a cup of coffee is going to cost me a lot of money, and leaving my money on the sidelines, that money actually is
losing value.
It's losing its value after taxes and even modest inflation. It's losing value. So I've got to manage my personality risk, my human nature risk, by really dividing, back to your point, Tammy, I really divide short-term and long-term money, And that gives me more confidence to say, boy, sure glad I don't have to go to that pile of money when you see a big market drop.
Right.
Karen, you actually answered an email question without knowing that it was good. And the emailer said, do you still believe in staying the course in volatile markets despite what happened a couple years ago?
Yeah.
It seems that the retail investor has a strategy of being all in or totally out. And I think you said no to that. And currently, for the most part, they are out of the market. Second, how many publications suggest, and this is really a second question, but you answered the first one.
But, you know, to that point, that first question, Bob, I would answer it differently for somebody who was retired and relying on their money than I would for somebody who is still employed. Somebody who's still employed, especially with the federal government, and having money 26 times a pay come out of their paychecks, I think they need to stay the course, unless they're really, really good at this. Out in 99, back in mm-hmm. middle of 2002, out again in 2007, just with it, I meet one or two people in my career who follow it. This is their hobby. They're a little sensitive to it. They get it. But the rest of us can't be that good. Getting out
at
the right time is actually the easy part. Getting back in is the hard part. So I do tell people who are still working that maybe what they should have is a little bit more in the G fund, but their bulk of their long-term money needs to be invested for growth. And 26 times a year when the market's falling apart, you got to be patting yourself on the back saying, I am shopping on sale. Look at me, you know, mm-hmm. and it does take care of itself. I give a different answer to somebody who's in maybe that second or final third phase of retirement. When we're really relying on these portfolios, we either need some active management, somebody who is good at this, who can put some stop losses on the portfolio, or who can pick some investments that spin off some very predictable income to mitigate those market losses. Or, hey, you know what? You've done a great job. You got a ton of money here. Let's just sit on the sidelines.
And we still have a lot of CSRS folks who are retiring on their civil service retirement.
Yeah.
That's their income. That's what's paying the bills. And they've done a good job, for the most part, of saving money in the thrift plan. So I've met CSRS employees with 37 years of service who have $250,000 in the thrift.
Sure.
So for them, I would think they could be a little bit more aggressive because they don't really need it now.
And to me, I try not to use the word aggressive or not, because it implies that there's
gambling.
a gambling element to it. It's really being honest and consistent to your personal financial plan. If I'm a CSRS person and I've got some money in the thrift plan that I absolutely don't need anytime soon, I want the choice of using it later.
Mm-hmm.
And if I just leave that in the G fund or leave that in a cash position out of the market, you just throw out $250,000. That's a lot of money today. It's not 20 years from now.
Right.
And it's even less 35 years from now, which is the average life expectancy of a healthy person first year of retirement. It's a big deal.
Yeah, I think you hit a point, too, when you said about using the word aggressive and also the word gambling, because I had a woman in class a couple weeks ago, and she said, well, I have everything in the G fund because I'm not a gambler.
Right.
And I said, well, you don't have to be a gambler to put money in the stock market.
Right.
You just have to understand what you're doing.
Right. Right. It's hard to get people to understand that this is not this the game we're dealt into here. If you want to use the gambling analogy, is one where everybody plays. You know, you don't get the choice of saying my coffee isn't going to go up in price and my property taxes, oh, they're coming down just for me because my cost of living allowance isn't cutting it anymore. We will all face higher costs.
And right now, it's the everyday things like food and clothing and gasoline that are going up this year.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that retirees are spending money on, and it's going to cost more next year than it does this year.
I can't quote them, but the figures on how much my health care outpaces inflation, it's just huge. And health care, if I'm retired from the federal government, even though I've got fabulous health insurance and heavily subsidized, very grateful for that, it's the custodial care.
Actually the second part of this, third part of this question.
Yeah. It's that, you know, how much is it going to cost to have somebody come and check in on me when I lose my vision for the last 20 years of my life? Or how expensive is it going to be to have somebody spend the night when it's just not safe for me to
be alone?
To be alone for 12, 15 hours.
We hit that pretty hard last week with Art Stein, and we're going to hit it a lot harder. We're going to have the long-term care folks on a couple weeks. And the other, this is a friend of the show, actually in California, and one of the final questions he had here, what do you feel about putting half of your investment, your retirement funds into equities in retirement? I remember asking you that question. Do you remember that? I have to tell this story, and it was one of the great moments in time of the show, I thought. And you looked at me like, where are you, from Mars? And you said, Bob, inflation doesn't stop at retirement's door. I'll just never forget that. So,
all right. Well, that's a good line. I like it. Yeah, it really doesn't stop. But retirement from the federal government doesn't necessarily tell me what I need to know to answer the question correctly either. Somebody can retire from the federal government and continue to work. Somebody can retire from the federal government in very poor health. Somebody can be retired with brilliant health. So let's just go back to time frames. But I do believe that if I'm talking to an average young retiree with normal life expectancy, it would be a mistake to say no equities anymore, because we're looking at 30-some years. So again, if I've got a retiree who is planning to spend this money out there in the future, more than 5-10 years into the future, we've got to be in the market even longer than that. We got to be in equities.
Great answer. Great timing. We have a caller. Good morning. You on the line? Good morning. Hello.
Hi, I just had a quick question for your commentators. They stirred a memory here. I have some money in the thrift savings plan. I'm very happy with it there, low fees, blah, blah, blah. But at a certain age, do I have to roll it over, or will they will, I don't want their annuity is what I'm getting at. And it seemed to me, in the back of my mind, when I left the government, they said, well, if you don't do something by a certain age, they'll roll it into an annuity. I know at age 70 and a half, you have to start taking it out.
That's when they do it.
Right. But you have the choice to do anything else with it besides that. That's just the final last resort if you do nothing.
Right. I mean, I can roll it into an IRA at any point, right?
Right. We're going to call it a transfer into an IRA. And you can do that any time now. You hit on a good point, though. You said you like the thrift plan because you understand it and it has low fees. And as long as you don't need the money and you're thinking of it as long-term money, I'm kind of with you on that one. But I want you to make sure you understand why it has such low fees. And one of the reasons it has the low fees is because there's not a lot of investment choice. You're either going to be out of the market in the G fund or you're going to be totally in the market with a one bond choice or three different stock choices. They're index funds. And an index fund has a low fee because nobody does anything. You don't have to do any research. You get a large primate hitting F10 at the end of the day. It's sort of a formula.
But most index funds beat managed funds.
Yes and no.
Yeah, well, For
long-term growth, I think you might as well do index funds. But when you start actually having to take required minimum distributions out of this, or heaven forbid, actually rely on this money to supplement some increased costs in your life, you're actually just going to have to sit in the G fund or look for other investments.
Right.
Other investments don't have to be outrageously expensive, but they also can provide you with less market volatility. Between now and when you move it into an IRA, you'd be wise to be just starting to understand what's a balanced fund, what's an equity income fund, let me look at some managed funds. Look at funds that didn't take the full market drop. That's what somebody who's spending money out of a portfolio needs to get interested in. Slightly higher fees, but we're not talking about commissions here. We're just talking about the fees that it takes to manage a fund when somebody's getting paid to make a decision. So that's a reason to move it, actually, is to get better investment choices for spending down your money.
And plus, at that point in time, when you are required to take those minimum distributions from the TSP, you'd have to do it on a monthly schedule, where if you had transferred it to another IRA where you're invested more broadly, you can take the money out as you need it as long as you meet that required distribution each year.
Right. But I guess, in review, though, there is no – they don't mandatorily – I mean, they don't
Now they'll send you a notice. Yeah, they'll send you a notice the year before you hit that required minimum distribution and letting you know that that's coming up and you have to make a choice and you can choose any of those above options.
Okay.
The one problem that happens, and I'll tell you that a lot of people don't receive that notice because it comes back to the TSP return to sender. So make sure you've kept your address up to date if you've moved since retirement.
Oh, I see. But the notice typically would come a year before you're...
The summer before you're facing those required distributions.
For whatever reason, let's say you don't get it.
Right.
The notice. You mentally now know to put the alarm clock on a year in advance.
Right.
To do it. And another thing to remember, too, it's not an all or none deal. If you're just really wedded to the thrift, you as a general term, not to the caller, you can leave some of the money in the thrift and move the rest over, and as Karen say, go shopping for the one that would provide you the best guidance. And so you can take a monthly payment. Now that goes on to another show, the type of monthly payment to take, but there's one that's very attractive that you control each year as to what you take out. So,
right.
Anyway. All righty.
Okay, well, I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling.
Have a good day.
You too. All righty. We're at 202-465-3080. And we talked about dollar cost averaging kind of. It's kind of like something on sale. And you buy low because you're averaging in with the other costs. But this might be not just once. It could be periodic. If you do it monthly or if you do it quarterly.
Right. The thrift contributions are actually a form of dollar cost averaging. You hear that terminology in any, you know, financial planning 101 book, what's the best way to invest? Take what money you feel you can invest and systematically put it into the market. If I really had $12,000 to invest today, and well, the market's closed, first thing tomorrow morning, I'm going to invest it. Just my luck. Markets could have opened low overseas. We got a big drop, and I'm the lucky person buying in at a great price. But the same thing could have happened in the reverse. Markets surged overseas. By the time my purchase goes off, I'm buying at a high price, and it may take a while for me to see appreciation from that. So rather than get all worked up about, is today really the day to buy? Is this a good day? Oh my gosh. I mean, I've never had this kind of money before. What am I going to do? Just divide it by 12 and once a month for the next 12 months have $1,000 going into the market. And it takes away that pressure to pick a great day, and it averages out the cost. So I bought some at higher prices and lower prices. Overall, I am less inclined when I do my systematic dollar cost averaging to keep watching it and saying, oh, what a mistake, and perhaps even the biggest mistake, watch it drop a little and get out. So systematically investing is actually the best way to manage human nature risk.
If you're going to withdraw a portion of your TSP account and you wanted to do that, you could elect to take that portion that you wanted to transfer to the IRA rather than as one big block of money. You could do it as a monthly payment of even $3,000 a month that you want to systematically, as you said, you know, move it slowly into the market rather than all at once move $100,000.
It just depends on you know, how old you are, how likely you are to need to spend this money. Very often when we're transferring money at retirement or shortly after retirement from a thrift to an IRA, we're going from the market to the market. It's an electronic transfer. So if I've been pretty happy with my index funds and I'm not really planning to spend the money, I'm probably just going to find a discount brokerage firm that has very, you know, cost-effective index funds and tell them when the thrift money arrives, just buy me the same thing. So it's kind of a wash. It got sold and purchased basically at the same time, and I don't worry about it. But I will say that when everybody's nervous and people are saying, oh, I want to move my thrift money to the IRA so I better control on it, but look at what the market is. I'm so nervous it's going to keep dropping. That's when we tell people, just go ahead and transfer it to your new IRA custodian's money market fund and have it systematically repurchased for you. So that
rather than trying to pick the stocks all
exactly
at one time,
right,
put it into something safe and then move it.
Put it into something that doesn't have any market volatility, and any IRA custodian can then systematically start moving it automatically once a month into three different mutual funds that have what you need. You can always call them up and say, forget the slow boat. put it all in. But I think it's a very graceful way to make solid investment decisions. Pretty easy to do.
Karen, I think people have a handle or on what a mutual fund is. Mm-hmm. But in the last number of years, there's this thing called an exchange-traded fund.
Right.
What's that?
That's a newfangled. We were hoping they were considered new and improved mutual funds. Mutual funds, as most people have heard, are just investment companies that they're in the business of making investments. That's exactly what you have in your thrift savings plan. So there's all they do is exactly what the prospectus or investment objective says. So in the C fund, it's a mutual fund that I can buy anywhere at any brokerage firm that only invests in the 500 stocks that comprise the S&P 500. It's a formula. You want to be an expert in the S&P 500, you need 30 minutes, internet access, read about it, nothing mysterious, right? But I could have a mutual fund that invests in stocks and bonds. I could have a mutual fund that invests according to the whims of the investment committee. I mean, it would have an investment objective that says this is what we do. They can't do anything other than the investment objective, but it could be we're all about making income, or we're all about growth, or we're all about real estate, or we're all about precious metals. We're all about whatever we think is good under a full moon. There will be an investment objective, and that's what it does. But this bucket of investments would only get priced once a day. So even though I could have said in the morning, wow, this is a great day to buy, by the time I sell, I got the price of tomorrow. So an exchange-traded fund said, wait, this is the 21st century. We have computers. We know how to do this. We don't have to wait until the end of the day and give everybody the same price. If you want to sell your exchange-traded fund, say sell. And as soon as the sell goes off, that's what you got. And what's supposed to happen there is they're supposed to be a little bit more transparent, supposed to be a little bit easier to do tax planning on them, which is an irrelevant consideration when we're talking about thrift and IRAs. But certainly in a lot of portfolios, something that we reach for to use. A little easier.
Do you think they're preferable to mutual funds?
Yeah, they're a type of mutual fund. I don't know. There's going to be no management, right? It's just, it is what it is. Here's the price. So I think it's another tool that we all use.
And where do you buy them?
Oh, the same place that you would buy a mutual fund that was a more traditional fund. You need a brokerage firm. So you can do it online yourself, or you can walk into an office. Anytime you're walking into an office and getting somebody to help you, it's important that you ask, how much does this help cost? Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily, I kind of have a sense of what I want to buy. I'm just not licensed to do it myself. So I want to make sure it's not a
What's the difference between a stockbroker and a financial planner?
Legally, nothing. You know, there's no legislative definition of who is a stockbroker and who is a financial planner. Historically, a stockbroker is somebody who works for a brokerage firm and is licensed to sell the products that have selling arrangements with that brokerage firm. Financial planner is a term that started coming into use about 40 years ago in this country. And it was really a person who at least said that they wanted to offer more advice or more guidance.
Where they're looking out for your best interest.
Simply the product. The problem is there's no requirement that they look out for your best interest. I can call myself a financial planner without being certified. But if I'm a certified financial planner, I have been held to a fiduciary standard since I put those letters after my name. And a fiduciary standard does mean I have to do what's best for my client. So if a client comes in and says, I want some exchange traded funds, or I don't want to put money in the thrift plan, I want to do this really aggressive thing, I have to say, as nicely as I can, that's not in your best interest. You need to be paying off your credit card debt, fully funding your thrift, and even though I can't make any money managing this wild, crazy investment for you, it's in your best interest. So,
and how do you distinguish a financial planner who is doing that, looking out for your best interest, versus someone who's trying to sell you something?
There are two questions I always have people go through before they take advice from anybody. And first, even before we start looking at people, it really is helpful if a potential customer of a financial planner, potential client, could articulate what it is they want. Mm-hmm. If they know they just want a second opinion, if they know they want some education, if they know they want some ongoing relationship and ongoing money management, they're more likely to spot that's not exactly what this sales pitch is all about, mm-hmm. right? But once I can articulate what it is I want, then I ask a person, advice comes from people, not from firms, what qualifies you to give me this advice? And I'm trying to fish around to find your experience, your education. Are you certified? Do you follow that fiduciary standard? Do you put my interests first? Can I understand what you're saying to me? Mm-hmm. You know, do you have that communication style that resonates with me? And once that goes well, you've passed the, you know, you're letting somebody pass that test, then you ask, what does it cost? Mm-hmm. We know what it costs. So if you get a mealy-mouthed answer to that, you know, like, I don't charge you anything, my firm pays me, or, you know, I am going to charge you a percentage of assets under management, and you were asking me really just about a second opinion about this voluntary contribution thing I'm thinking about doing. Your common sense would start to say, that's not exactly right. And what happens is, in a sales situation, you're trained, if you're a good salesperson, not to bring this up. Mm-hmm. So unless a potential consumer brings it up, you can be many, many steps down the road to sign here, sign here, with no idea that you're just letting the salesperson take tens of thousands of dollars out of your pocket over the next couple of years. I mean, the fees can be huge, or the commissions can be really hard to spot in the paperwork that you're signing.
Right. And I think in my mind, too, financial planning is not just about managing your right. retirement asset or right. your money you're going to pay for your kids' college, but it's also about estate planning. It's about tax issues. It's about
managing risk, managing market risk, mm-hmm. managing risk through the right insurance products, understanding the interconnected financial planning issues intergenerationally, now that we have 3 and 4 generations living, you know, unless you're going to move no forwarding address, I got a feeling we better talk about these things, right?
Right.
So, there's a lot to it. It's like a puzzle that will fit together more than one way. And with somebody who has the right experience and training, we can actually try and fit it a few different ways and then find the one that works for you. Or we can give you some tools that will let you be more of a do-it-yourselfer, to start to anticipate life a little bit. Try to say, well, you know, if I don't make this decision now, it won't be there anymore. Or if I make this particular decision, like to buy this really nice car, it means I really have to work another few years.
I remember another Karen quote that always stuck with me, and that was when she told a class one time, she says, you are your financial planner.
That's right.
Oh, and absolutely. You have to start with that.
I start with that almost every time mm-hmm. I'm in front of an audience. I'm not the planner. You are, mm-hmm. right?
You know what's going in,
the
coming
planner,
out.
Mm-hmm. Right?
All right, we got 3 emails that need planning.
Okay. I'm ready.
All right. Question 1, assuming one can pay off their mortgage, then under what circumstances would it be wise to pay off one's mortgage going into retirement? That's the first part of it. Are other considerations where it might be a better move to continue to pay the monthly payment?
Mm-hmm. I love this question, and I love the way it was worded, that, you know, we actually have a choice, because a lot of these rules of thumb about you have to do this or you have to do that. No, most people have choices in life. So what we do here, when it comes to the mortgage, it depends on a couple of things, whether it would make any sense to accelerate payments or just take a chunk of money and hand it over to the lender and say, done with you. And part of it is, what else would you be doing with the money? What else should you be doing with the money? What else do you need to be doing to meet your personal financial goals here? And what's the cost of actually keeping this mortgage out? So when interest rates are as low as they are, and there's something better for me to do with my money, I'm probably not going to accelerate payments and hurry up and get this mortgage done. Better things to do with my money: fully contribute to thrift, fully do the catch-up provision on thrift, fully contribute to IRAs, do the catch-up provision on IRAs for me and my spouse, even if my spouse is already retired. That's a ton of money. $22,000 going into thrift for somebody who's 50 and older, mm-hmm. $6,000 or $12,000 for married couples going into IRAs, all of that better than accelerating payments on an inexpensive mortgage. And mortgages are pretty darn inexpensive yeah. right now. It would also make more sense to clean up more expensive debt. If I've got some credit card debt that's been hanging, if I've got some other, you know, help the kids with their college, and I've got this rather substantial number, it probably makes more sense to clean that up than to hurry up and get this mortgage done.
This is psychology to writing the check. We can't deal with psychology, but the thrift can help us be a shrink in the sense that you can take monthly payments out of the thrift. I get a lot of questions in class, but you all do too. I want to take my thrift money out and pay my mortgage.
Yeah, yeah.
No,
take
monthly payments, the B option, where you can maneuver it around.
And, just take more out than you owe because you have to pay tax on it.
You got to pay the taxes on it, yeah.
Right. No, what happens? The other thing I like people to think about when they get focused on, I want to get my mortgage done, is how inflexible a fully paid for house is compared to a home with an appropriate, modest, should be modest at this stage of life if you're really in pre-retirement land, mortgage and a big thrift and some nice IRA money and just some a little extra money hanging around. All of those other pockets of money I can just go to if I get the wild card where everything that requires money happens in 1 year. Mm-hmm. Hopefully my life will be a little bit more paced, a little bit more gently for me. But if it's not, if I have to get my hands on money, I can't just sell the back porch. I can't count on refinancing. Mm-hmm. I'm retired and interest rates could be through the roof. So just it's the flexibility that I love to see in a good financial plan.
Here's one that you could talk an hour on, but it's a one-sentence question. It's a good question. Should someone keep money in the TSP, say the 2020 fund, after being retired, or move it to an IRA with higher fees?
It's almost the same as the caller called in.
Right. Yeah. And again, I would say if the 2020 fund is like next up, that's mostly G fund right now. And by 2020, it's going to be vast majority in the G fund. So to me, the first thing is, what's the purpose of this money? If this is a CSRS person who isn't tapping the money, living reasonably well on just their pension, this is money in their ideal financial plan for the grandbaby's college education. It shouldn't be in the 2020 fund right now. That's not enough growth.
Right.
But if this is money that by 2020, hello, we're going to be spending it, most of it, I don't mind it sitting in the 2020. But eventually, I do like people to understand that we can get money to a traditional IRA without paying any tax. We can buy stuff that has very low, not as low as a thrift plan, but very hundreds of a decimal point. I mean, we're talking very comparable kinds of fees, and then give you the flexibility you need when you really do want to spend the money.
Okay. The last email actually came in this morning. Tammy sent it over, and we already dealt with half of it, IRS Notice 2009-68. But the second part was if a married couple and the one has a survivor's annuity and the one that had the annuity passes, in other words, passing along then a survivor's annuity, is the value of that survivor's annuity included in the estate? And the answer is yes.
Sure.
And before somebody said, this is awful, there's an equal subtraction to the penny to the amount going to the spouse. So
Provided
what?
The spouse is a U.S. citizen.
Ah.
Because if the spouse is not a U.S. citizen, there is no marital deduction unless we have a qualified domestic trust, which is no big deal. If you've gone to any estate planning attorney worth paying, they're going to ask everybody a citizen here. And if not, they'll put this
clause in.
It's a little trust. And if the spouse becomes a citizen in the meantime, it becomes one of those many never mind things in estate planning documents. But you're absolutely right. It's in the estate. And for the vast majority of folks, it will come out as a fully deductible part of the estate, and therefore not taxable.
Is that a special note to your State Department, World Bank clients?
No, actually, I'm Canadian. Yeah, I'm a first-generation American. Everybody in my family's Canadian. You can't tell it until we say a or about. We talk about Chesterfields and not couches.
The other part of that question, I know we don't have a whole lot of time left, but what about the option of instead of taking a reduced retirement to provide the survivor annuity, what about buying life insurance? Is there a quick answer
Tammy,
to that?
Tammy, this question came up a couple times in class this week, and I was kind of shocked by it. It's not a good idea. It's just really not a good idea because the amount of life insurance that you have to buy to replace the survivor benefit is outrageously expensive.
A lot more than you think.
Okay. Term insurance can't do it.
We be done. Thanks, Karen. Thanks, Tammy. Come back next week. We'll be on.
Sounds great.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP.
Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
The Federal News Radio Community Spotlight is on the UDC Foundation. Why give to UDC? Well, the University of the District of Columbia, celebrating its 160th anniversary.